Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
First of all, the policymaking process in California is not dead. It's just on the really big issues, not the little issues. Legislature deals with the little issues all the time. The 800 bills the questioner asked about is accurate. But on the big issues, it's not where the action is. On the big issues, it's the initiative process that makes those judgments and has been making those judgments for a long time. So why is that? Well, the fact is, at least in my view, the legislature for a long, long time has been characterized by its failure to come to grips with the fundamental policy choices that confront our state. And this policymaking gridlock, this everyone calls it dysfunction today, this dysfunction has created a vacuum which has been filled largely by the initiative process on the big issues and, to a lesser extent, the state regulatory process and the courts. They're very much involved in the governing of California as well. Now, I'm not going to bore all of you with the 442 initiatives that have been on the ballot since 1976, and if I went back to 1911, it would be a lot more than that. But I do want to take a quick review of some of the policy areas initiatives have covered, because I think it will help illustrate just how pervasive and consequential the initiative process is in the making of California public policy, because everybody talks about it, but nobody really focuses. Well, what is it that the initiative process has really done that's so consequential? Well, we'll talk about tax and spending policy. We all know about Prop 13. So the initiative, Californians have used the initiative process to roll back and limit property taxes. They've also used the initiative process to abolish the inheritance and gift tax. But they've also used the initiative process to raise tobacco taxes twice, to raise taxes on millionaires. In fact, our president pro tem of our legislature is the sponsor of that tax on millionaires. We've used the initiative process to put a cap on government spending. That's been discussed today. We've also used the initiative process to eliminate that cap a number of years later. In the criminal justice area, we've used the initiative process to do victims' bill of rights laws, death penalty laws, three strikes you're out laws, and numerous other types of criminal policy matters. I don't know if Mr. Bagley is going to talk about it, but I happen to know the Political Reform Act is not his favorite law. And the fact is, the Political Reform Act was created by the way, another elected official, Jerry Brown. That's created the Fair Political Practice Commission. That was created by initiative. Our Coastal Protection Act was created by initiative. Our lottery was created by initiative. We rolled back insurance rates by initiative. We created an elected insurance commissioner by initiative. We imposed term limits by initiative. We legalized Indian gaming by initiative. We prevented the use of race in UC admissions by initiative. Roughly 40% of our state government spending is set aside for K through 14 by ballot measure. So today, right now as we speak, there are three initiatives on this ballot. By the way, all of them put on by legislators on the June ballot. And there are a number of other initiatives that are circulating. And there are 57 initiatives that are presently in circulation or pending issuance of title and summary by the state attorney general for the November election. So I'm going to stop. But I'm trying to make a point, which is it's the initiative process, not the legislative process, where the major policy is being made and has been made for the last 25, 30, 35 years. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we can deal with in the Q&A. But this panel is supposed to talk, as I understand it, about the cure. And if the cure is a more effective and functional legislature, I don't think the solution, frankly, is lowering the. I agree with a lot of the panelists. You know, it's not lowering the threshold for votes on budget or taxes, or frankly, you're going to get this in the next session, a constitutional convention, or some of the other more limited things that people are talking about. The cure, quite frankly, is to elect better quality legislators, legislators who are capable of resolving enormously complex problems, and they are enormously complex, in a responsible way, in a pragmatic way. And I'd like to emphasize the word pragmatic, because I don't think it's a word that's used by either the Republican or the Democratic caucuses today. In a mature way, I think I'd like to emphasize that word as well, and in a bipartisan way. So how do we get there? Well, I'm going to suggest, these have all been talked about today, they've been touched on, but I'm going to suggest three reforms that I believe are key to improving the quality of our legislative leadership. One is redistricting reform. Okay, let the voters choose their legislators instead of the legislators choosing their voters. Well, guess what? We already did it. We did it in something called Proposition 11. It was in the last election cycle. It hasn't been implemented yet. We're not certain how it's going to work. But taking the legislature out of the redistricting process, where they have a clear interest in giving themselves safe seats, so a left-wing legislator can be as left-wing as possible without consequences, and a right-wing legislator can be as right-wing as possible without consequences, I think the fact that we've taken redistricting out of the hands of the legislature is going to help. Now, sometimes there are unintended consequences with these initiatives, so who knows? But I think it's going to help. I think taking the legislature out of that process is a good thing. Second, let's move to an open primary. I can't wait to hear Bill Bagley give his talk. He's going to talk about the Golden Age. I know he's got a book coming out on that. But I don't know how he can talk about that Golden Age without mentioning cross-filing. And I'm not preempting what he's going to say. That's all I'm going to say. But I will say that the open primary is akin to cross-filing. Like redistricting reform, I think it's going to lead to the election, for reasons that Jim Brulte explained, of less ideological and more pragmatic legislators of both parties. So, I want to be a little bit optimistic, particularly after what we've heard today. We've already passed redistricting reform. We already have open primary on the ballot. As part of last year's budget resolution, it's going to be on the ballot in June. Don't know whether it's going to make it or not. But we're almost two-thirds there. And then the last reform that a lot of people have talked about, and I think is a very important reform, as important as the first two, is term limit reform. The imposition of term limits, a lot of people supported it for a lot of good reasons, but it has turned out to be a policy mistake. And I don't think anybody can disagree with that today. California is complex. It's very complex to govern, more complex today than it was when I worked in the governor's office, when Jerry Brown was governor, when Pat Brown was governor. It's a much more complex state to manage. It's difficult to govern. And we need men and women in the legislature with experience. I had the privilege of working with the likes of Ken Matty, his name is mentioned, and Willie Brown, and a number of others, Phil Eisenberg, Richard Katz, Bob Naylor, others. Well, they had experience. You know, Willie Brown, before he became Speaker, I think was in the legislature for 20 years. He had served on every major policy committee, chaired the budget committees. Okay, you cannot expect a Speaker that's been there for 5 years or 4 years to have that kind of expertise, regardless of how smart or able or talented that individual may be. So to summarize, in my opinion, the so-called cure to legislative dysfunction, immaturity, irresponsibility, of which I think we've had a lot of by both parties, is to elect men and women who are functional, mature, and responsible. In my view, it's that simple. And at numerous times in our history, and I'm sure in the Q&A we can go back to those times, but at numerous times in our history, we have had men and women who met that standard, who basically were able at the end of the day to check their ideological differences at the door and sit down and do not necessarily what's in their individual constituent interests, but in the interest of the state of California as a whole. So I believe if we make those three changes, we can attract better quality men and women to public service again, and the legislature can begin to reclaim its proper role in the making of public policy and begin to fill that vacuum that has been filled largely by the initiative process. Although we'll always have the initiative process, it's here to stay. Don't delude yourself in thinking it's going to be seriously changed or modified. You saw the polling data today by PPIC. Field has similar polling, private polling. The initiative process, if you ask people, who do you trust to solve your problems? The legislature, it's down around 10%. The governor, it's about 18%. The people, through the initiative process, look at 60, 65, 70%. That's where the public is. That's not going to be changed. But we can make a number of these changes to, in my view, create an environment to get a more a more capable group of legislators elected who can begin grappling with these enormously complex problems that confront our state. Thank you very much.
I'm very pleased to be here today because, you know, I went to the California legislature about 7 years ago to work on education, to work on the environment. I chaired the Natural Resources Committee for 4 years, but in the Senate, I'm chairing the Committee on Elections and Constitutional Amendments. And I'm doing that because it became clear to me over time that until we make some substantive changes in the way we govern ourselves to fit the 21st century, California will continue in the free fall that it's been in for the last number of years. A free fall that's very frightening to many of us who lived here in the last great building era of the 1960s and remember that we used to be the envy of the nation. That was California's exceptionalism. Now we're pretty much an international joke. And partly it's because our systems have not kept up with reality. And the great thing about democracy is that the people can fix it, and it's an evolving thing. So there's a number of things we can do. I know that we'll be speaking of a constitutional convention later. My feeling about that is, in terms of what we need to do, that I would like to see us, because of the severity of the situation in which we find ourselves, take action in the next year or so on a number of areas in which I believe there is wide general agreement. Maybe not on this panel, but I think among the numbers of good government groups that have formed from California Forward and others to many other organizations, there's general agreement on these. And I would call that the majority vote to have a state budget. We are one out of three states that require two-thirds. The other two are Rhode Island and Arkansas. It has not worked well for us because you have to look at the outcomes. Term limits, I think everyone agrees that what started out as a good idea has really had disastrous consequences, the increasingly inexperienced dealing with the increasingly complex, as Steve indicated. And I do have a constitutional amendment that I have put forward. It has a Republican principal co-author, Senator Roy Ashburn, which would have allow people to serve 12 years, but all in the same house, if they wished, or they could move, but 12 years total, and it would not apply to any sitting legislator. So hopefully we could move forward on that and have much greater stability in the state assembly and be able to have a more deliberative process. In addition, I serve on the Select Committee on Government Reform that has just been established by the leadership in both houses. And we are looking at a series of simple changes to the legislative calendar so that we have more of a two-year budget so we can spend more time doing oversight, looking at how we combine programs in bad years to make every dollar go further, that kind of really deliberative process. But then I think California may need to look at a constitutional convention if we're to have a statewide, hopefully honest conversation, not full of quips and everybody making their ego points, but a real conversation about the role of government, taxes, and what we do need to pool our money to buy together because we can't afford to buy them separately, and when government is being intrusive and should, as some of my colleagues have said, take their hand out of our wallet. Because, as has been pointed out, frequently people will say, you know how to spend your money better than other people do. Yeah, unless you're trying to buy a school or a university or a road or a high-speed rail system or a bus or a train. in which case you may have to pool your money. And we need to talk about that. It is no accident that both California Forward and the Parsky Tax Commission did not even talk about Prop 13. It's considered the third rail of California politics. If we could have a constitutional amendment convention that could honestly engage Californians from all walks of life in that discussion, it would be very positive. There are a number of ways we can move forward. I don't know. My hope is that we'll end up with a select committee on government reform, having every senator that sits on that committee become a principal co-author of my term limits smooth out, because everyone seems to agree that that's a problem. Another issue that I've been very concerned about has been the influence of money on political decision-making, who can run, who can serve. And I've been very interested in public financing of elections for many years and put forward legislation. It's difficult to do that, even though I think the people would get their money back many times over in a bad economic climate. However, last year the legislature passed and the governor signed a constitutional amendment that I put forward, which would have allow public financing on a pilot basis for the Office of Secretary of State, using the system that has been in place for about 10 years now in Maine and Arizona, and that works very well and has a majority of legislators of both parties in those states voluntarily using the public financing system. And then I believe there will be an initiative put forward on a majority vote to pass a state budget. And let me just briefly say, I think that's very important for two reasons: transparency and what I call the takeaways. It is very difficult when you have a situation of a majority of any one party, and you know, right now in California, there is a solid majority of Democrats, but not two-thirds in either house. And yet, you cannot get a budget to send the governor because of the two-thirds vote requirement. It means that you don't know whose trade-offs are where. You don't know if corrections would be cut or higher education would be cut or funding for roads would be cut, because it becomes totally murky. And when I first arrived, we did things like kind of got the extra Republican votes at the end of the process with swimming pools in the district or something that somebody wanted. Last year, we did tax cuts in order to pass a budget that cut billions of dollars. And we put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that had nothing whatever to do with the budget to get one of the Republican votes. Now, this means the public has no way of holding us accountable. And I think that it would be much cleaner and lead to more compromise if we had the majority vote. There are many concerns about the initiative system as well. It is here. It can be used as the tool of the people, as it was set up to be in 1911 by Hiram Johnson when the railroads ran California. Can also be a simple tool of anybody who has $3 million to pay some funders and go out and get what amounts to a public subsidy for their own company, although the voters, to their credit, have turned several of those down in recent years. So there are ways that we can move forward together. The good news for me is all of a sudden everybody realizes that it's broken and we have to fix it. And that's the genius of democracy. When people set their mind to something and understand it, we can fix it. And since democracy is still the best hope of humankind to live together in some kind of dignity and promise, there is no historical task worth doing more carefully and better than that right now at this period of time. So I'm so glad you're all here. Thank you.
In the 60s, UC's incidental fee was $100 a year. It's now $10,000 and going up. My friends, that is a 10,000% increase in 50 years. inflation is about 1,000%. We have experienced the abject abdication of the California government and the legislature. We, meaning you, I, here in UC and around the state. Some present candidates say they are going to cut 40,000 state employees and they're going to help education. Please beware, my friends, of candidates with a lot of money who are pervert, who are lying, I'll say it out loud, to get elected. And that hasn't happened just recently. You know, I can go back too far, and I won't. Beware, my friends, of ideologues and initiatives, particularly if they go together in trouble. And that's what's happened to California, and I needn't go into great detail. The irony is that we need initiatives to clean up the mess. So you can't avoid them all. Politics and physics are very similar. Vacuums attract. Things happen that nobody understood, and we're going to talk about a few of those things and how to fix them. One of my themes in life has been people that play together, stay together. And I'm talking about the state legislature now. You know, in government, I paraphrase General Electric, the process is the most important product. So let's focus on the process. All my political life, and that's from the fifth grade forward, I've been a pragmatist. I'm an optimist. I'm an evangelical moderate. Think about that for a second. I fear for the state. I actually sit home at night and worry about whether the state's going to survive as a governable, I can say it, as something that's subject to governance. And that's why we're here. I don't want to address long-term solutions. Anybody can talk about what's going to happen, 15 years from now. It takes 1,000 years to reach the millennium, just by definition. So I've got two or three short-term solutions, some of which have been mentioned. And then we're going to go backwards a little bit and analyze, you know, what needs fixing and why. Mention has been made of the open primary. In 2004, I was president. We had Leon Panetta, we had Becky Morgan, we had a half a dozen other people. And we didn't raise, Arnold Schwarzenegger's people did, a couple of $1 million to put on the ballot. The legislature, in a bipartisan act, the only time they've had bipartisanship of any magnitude, they put a poison pill on the ballot to kill the open primary because they didn't want anybody messing around, I've got other words to use, in their little party caucuses. The open primary by simple arithmetic. Joel Fox used San Francisco. I'll use Orange County. The Orange County moderate Democrat can vote in the Republican primary for a moderate Republican instead of a bug-eyed, bigoted, right-winger, butcher bastard. I used to call those right-wing people that I dealt with when I was there. That's the open primary, and it will be on the ballot, courtesy of Senator Abel Maldonado, who's getting recalled because he voted for the budget. He put the open primary in vogue, and it's on the ballot. And this time, let's not ignore that as a major, major effort to open the process to break the gridlock. It's just simple arithmetic. Reapportionment, everybody understands. I think almost all of the seats are vested and nested. And here's another irony for you. And I know this, Steve, I'm sure your presence in Sacramento, you could confirm it. The four-year members, and they're 4 years, it's not six-year terms in the assembly, because it's the 4 years. After that, you're a lame duck. But in the first 4 years, and then into the fourth, fifth, and sixth year, as an assembly person, we used to have assembly men and women. Now you have neuter genders. But assembly men and women in their first 4 years vote either far left or far right in order to establish themselves as a candidate viable in the Senate primary, and they know when it's coming up because of term limits and because the seats are virtually nested and vested. The irony is they can't compromise. They have to vote right wing because that's the only way you can get elected in their upcoming known open Senate seat. Known open Senate seat. That could be changed in a constitutional amendment so that they're not all vested together and nested. That's an easy one, very frankly, and it's an irony very few people realize exists. The two-thirds vote is not going to be changed. But here's a solution, my friends. In the 60s, when I was in the legislature, we did reasonably good things. Oh, we were number one in 1969, a Ford Foundation entity named the California legislature number one in the nation. Tell that to some of your legislators today. They don't know it. It might help. That in of itself might help change the culture, is a good word, that is extant in Sacramento. But the solution to the two-thirds vote is what we had before, frankly, Prop 13 and other initiatives. Education funds could be raised and spent with a majority vote. I had a bill once to tax all the Muni Electrics. PG&E had me put the bill in at 14% because that was the rate that PG&E said it was paying in taxes and the Munis ought to pay the same. That was popular for a while until it got killed. Because the money was all going to go to education, and it was a majority vote bill. There's a solution. There's a real solution, my friends. I was asked to give you a few solutions when I was up here talking. And initiatives, you're not going to kill them either, but you could have them, and this has been tried, you could have them reviewed by the legislature before they go on the ballot, and if they are reviewed, you get a certain threshold of signatures. If they're not reviewed, they have higher signatures. Easy enough. It's almost a volunteer effort. So, again, before reform, the legislature was number one. Before reform, and here's another point that needs to be made, and people don't realize it. Some people don't agree with me. We were all friends. We were all friends. There were no aisles. Al Elquist was my seatmate until the day he died at the age of 90. He wouldn't say hi, Bill. He'd say hi, seatmate. Those things don't happen today. Jack Knox, Assemblyman, District, Richmond. John Vasconcellos, Assemblyman, San Jose. They are my personal friends. They love me, I think, and I know I love them because we were friends in the legislature. Why were we friends? Because we could be there 10 or 12 years. I was there 14. Because, and here's number one on my list, we played together. People that play together stay together. The passage of Proposition 13 killed collegiality. Killed collegiality. Why? We're going to stop whining and dining of legislators. Whining and dining was a forum. Lobbyists would buy dinners, $10 dinners in those days, maybe 25 today, for 10 or 15 people, maybe in a hotel suite. Bipartisan, always bipartisan. We'd sit together, we'd eat together, we'd drink together, we'd play cards together. Oh, you could do that today, but you don't have to go out and buy dinner. You're not going to buy dinner for a Democrat. You're going to buy dinner for a Republican because you'd get accused of being a heretic if you did otherwise. You don't get together anymore. You know why? Proposition 10, 15, I could say it, 13, said, can't spend more than $10 a month on any legislator. It's absurd. Absolutely absurd. Also, when, I don't mean 13, I mean 9. Proposition 9 was the Jerry Brown proposition that created political reform. Proposition 13 brought to Sacramento the Prop 13 babies. It's an expression maybe a lot of you haven't heard. They were a bunch of right-wing type Republicans, and they decided we want to sit together. So they killed collegiality. No more Alquist seatmates. All of that are the causes, some of which were not mentioned today. Finances. Instead of a $10 or $20 or $5 dinner, tonight, today, you can spend $100,000 a week going to partisan fundraisers. $3,000, $4,000, $10,000 an entry. That's not democracy. And it, again, kills collegiality. I was there, my friend. I lived through it. I have friends across aisles. There were no aisles. We compromised. We were moderates. We live together. As Bill Lockyer said earlier today, we were there to govern. I have a few more things to say, and I'll say them later. Thanks so much.
Let me start by telling you that I recently read the late Senator Ted Kennedy's memoir, True Compass. It's an uneven book. It's fascinating when it's personal, but it's really tight-lipped, and I've cleaned that up, politically. But there was one particular paragraph that jumped right out at me. It was near the end of the book. And although it deals with the U.S. Senate, it really bears directly on what we're mulling over here today. I know you've heard the rhetoric before, even before all of the panels today, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, and I'm going to quote it. Quote, "I think the withering away of collegiality and sense of collective mission as the corruption of the Senate. I don't mean," Kennedy wrote, "corruption in a legal sense. Rather, I mean corruption in the sense that things are broken." End quote. Sound familiar? He argues that, quote, "the breakdown has been driven primarily by two factors. First," he says, "there are forces that actually do not want the Senate to meet and to be active in the affairs of the nations. Second is the distorted influence of money and the power of vested interests in the legislative process. I don't think," he added, "any unbiased observer can deny that the way campaigns are financed has an unhealthy influence on the legislative process." End quote. Well, that observation got me thinking about the question this panel is supposed to address. How can we move forward to solutions? Well, first of all, we have to look beyond the institutions. We've got to stop focusing only on, looking only for, and limiting change to mechanical solutions. There is no magic in campaign financing reform, I'm sorry to say. It hasn't cleaned out the stables yet, and we've tried time and time again. I agree with Senator Brulte's story about the ants, the money as ants, but the real observation was one by the late Democratic fundraiser Duane Garrett, and it was made at a conference right here in this room. And he said, quote, "Political money is like water running downhill. It will find its way around any obstacle to get to the bottom." End quote. There is no magic in a one-house legislature. I've watched Nebraska for decades, and I am here to tell you that a unicameral does not equal harmony. Factions erupt and stall legislation even in the so-called nonpartisan bodies. There is no magic in a part-time legislature. For those who argue that Californians who have to draw a salary elsewhere make better legislators, I have just one word: bribery. Now that is a nice supplemental paycheck. Just ask, if you could, the late lobbyist and the self-styled governor of the state of California, governor of the legislature, Artie Sandwich. You can't get around this. Now, proponents have long argued that the part-time legislature would return professional lawmakers to the title of citizen legislators. Well, as was mentioned earlier, that's what term limits, our draconian term limits, were supposed to do. Instead, they have revved up a perpetual game of musical chairs among professional politicians. There is no assurance that a part-time citizen legislature would be more reflective of or more responsive to the state's diverse population. Before Prop 1A, which established the full-time legislature, what you saw in the state capitol were largely lawyers, insurance agents, others whose occupations were flexible enough and whose bank accounts were fat enough to allow them to take time off from their so-called real jobs, mainly in the corporate sector. even if California succeeds in establishing a part-time legislature, it will not succeed in abolishing the full-time body. We could return, and Mr. Bagley knows this very well, we could return to serial special sessions. Oh, wait, we're there already. Arnold Schwarzenegger has called 16 of them since he took office with this full-time legislature. These special elections were the way the legislature worked before the late Assembly Speaker Jess Unruh began his push for widespread legislative reform and for the full-time legislature. As part of a major constitutional revision in 1966, Unruh pushed for that full-time legislature, arguing that the part-time legislature didn't really exist anymore. What Prop 1A did, Unruh argued, was merely institutionalize an already de facto full-time body. I'm not going to dwell on this now. One thing that I liked about the shortened tenure in Sacramento was that in so-called interim hearings, legislators got out to the hustings, got out to their districts, went and looked at what was going on. And that, by and large, except for a photo op now and then, has gone by the boards. And at some point, I'd like Mr. Bagley to address that. Now, I guess by now we understand that one of the things that really needs reform is the initiative process, this just in. But again, I am convinced that the real problems aren't merely mechanical. I don't think that the abolition of the initiative is politically realistic. It's been for too long a part of the ethos of California. And as Jack showed us this morning, Californians like it. Real initiative reform requires the Californians, us, we, not the legislature, we understand that there is no such thing as a free lunch. You can't decide to micromanage the government.
I had thousands of free lunches.
I know, but that was before Prop 9.
The lobbyists just to buy them.
That was before Prop 9. You cannot expect to micromanage government and then expect elected officials to be accountable for or prevent them from cleaning up after you when it's over. Then there is that mystical and mythical silver bullet, the Constitutional Convention. Just let me say to those who insist that the Constitutional Convention agenda can legally be limited to narrowly drawn topics, I have three words for you. Town hall meetings. Just try to control the agenda. Limit the debate for activists on any side, on any subject, who have other ideas. Okay, so I've grouched my way through what I think is the folly of relying merely on systemic reform, on tweaking the mechanics of governance. I have always believed, and I will continue to believe, that any system is only as good as the people who inhabit it. And that leads to my response to our panel's question. I see three factors as crucial. One, communication. Two, its close cousin, education. Three, leadership. All of them have been alluded to in one way or another today. When I talk about communication, I talk about honest communication by politicians to Californians about the mess we're in and what we have to consider to get out of it, and vice versa, voter to elected official. Just spell things out without vitriol. But that requires mutual trust, doesn't it? And again, Jack showed us this morning that's terribly lacking right now in California. And I'm talking about any communication at all on the part of a media that's fixated on the circus of politics to the exclusion of the substance of policy. And that assumes that you can find any so-called mainstream media left that can or want to cover state government and politics. Attitude, be it the 24/7 cable nets, talk radio, blogs, Facebook, Twitter, in Congress, in the legislature, whatever, is everything. These days, we tend to listen only to what we want to hear, not to what we should hear. Concerning education, it was the philosopher John Locke who complained that we teach children how to be carpenters or farmers or any other trade, but we do not teach them how to be citizens. Indeed, in these days of dwindling educational resources and overburdened schools, it's hard enough to teach, period. And as Senator Hancock rightly pointed out, teaching on the statewide issues is necessary even after our children leave the education system. And perhaps the hardest reform to come by, let alone defined, is leadership. The only way I can define it is I'll know it when I see it. And I don't see it now. Will there ever be the political will, the courage to face our state's crumbling fiscal, economic, political, social, cultural infrastructures? All of them, and to make the hard choices, whatever they may ultimately be, and we don't even know that yet, necessary to govern. This whole reform thing is not going to be easy. It's neither simple nor painless, and Californians should not be conned into believing that it will be. That's how voter distrust, cynicism, and alienation take root. The blue smoke and mirrors that have defined politics and government in this state for so long are as responsible for the dysfunctional funk that California is in as are our tanking economy, the ongoing partisan gridlock, which, by the way, puts me in the camp of those who think that redistricting is not enough. We need the open primary attached, or this deep-seated voter distrust of government and politicians. I'm going to end my remarks here by saying, quite honestly, I'm not really sure how or whether we can move toward solutions to what ails California. Anyway, we first have to agree on what does ail California, and I'm not sure we've done that yet today. But we all, politicians, community leaders, media, academicians, citizens, activists, interests, voters, Californians, everybody who cares about this state has got to stop diddling around and take a deep breath, survey the terrain, put one foot in front of the other, and get on with it. And I'll save the rest of my remarks for later. Thank you.
I want to preface my proposed solutions for California's future by drawing some lessons from California's past and looking at some other states to try to get a sense of where our biggest problems are in our political system and what the scale is of these problems so that we're tailoring appropriate solutions that fit the problems rather than throwing out the things that work in California government. But I want to start this discussion with the here and now and talk about the paradox of May 19th. So that date that we'd like to all forget was the date of our disastrous special election that we had in California where you know, the legislators on both sides of the aisle made these tough choices to raise taxes and cut spending, and voters decided, of all stripes, decided they hated that, and we started our way into a summer of discontent. But on that same day, do you guys remember where our governor was? Governor was in Washington, D.C., to have President Obama praise California's landmark global climate change bill, AB 32, as the nation's model for addressing perhaps the world's most pressing policy problem. So how could the same political system that produced AB 32 also produce this mess? And do we need to look at both sides of that political system? Another way to phrase this is to say, is our Constitution a bloated, obsolete document that's driven us into despair that needs to be chucked entirely? Or is it the foundational document that's guided us through more than 100 years of incredible economic growth, united a heterogeneous body like the world's never seen, and that we are all in many ways very happy with 5 or 6 years ago? So what I want to do to try to sort out this conundrum is really talk about California's two governments, Because we have two processes that work differently and I think should be judged differently. So our two governments, we have a legislative government that comes up with the normal bills that pass every year. And this is a majoritarian system that operates with 50% plus one votes. And it performs quite well on a couple objective criteria. Second system we have is a budget system that requires consensus across party lines. And in recent years is obviously not performing well. And I want to talk about two ways to evaluate each of these systems real quickly before I go to solutions. The first one is the obvious one that we look at a lot, the efficiency of government. How quickly does the legislative and the budget process resolve our problems? Now, that's important because budget delays have real costs, and legislative delays not solving the pressing problems can delay solutions. But that's not the whole picture. A second criteria on which we should evaluate government is whether it's responsive. Does the final decision of government in California reflect what voters want whenever it is reached? So I'm going to present a little bit of data on each of those that draws on history and California's past. So in this graph, we have a solid line, and the solid line is partisan polarization in the legislature. It's drawn from work that Seth Maskin and Jeff Lewis at UCLA have done, taking every vote cast in the history of the California Assembly. What you see is actually, and what it really summarizes, is how far apart the average Republican and the average Democrat is in the state legislature. What you see is starting in the 30s all the way through the cross-filing period, we weren't that far apart. Our party caucuses weren't far apart. Starting in the late 60s and continuing, and including also continuing unabated through the two election cycles where we had the blanket primary, 98 and 2000. The blanket primary didn't change this at all. And accelerating with term limits and all the recent changes, we've seen skyrocketing polarization. It's at historically high levels in California. And if you look at data like this from legislatures across the country, we're number one in partisan polarization in California. And a lot of people said, well, that means that the legislature can never do anything. So superimposed is this dotted line, which is the gridlock percentage in California, calculated in the first year of every gubernatorial term by a group of research assistants I worked with who looked at what the LA Times said were the 8 to 10 to 12 biggest issues before the legislature in every year, going back to 1931, or in every 4 years. And then we looked at to see which of these issues the legislature's resolved. And the percent that they didn't resolve is in this dotted line. It's the gridlock percentage. So California has always had some gridlock. It's bounced around, but it doesn't seem to be always going up with partisan polarization. In fact, what predicts it is gridlock's about 25% higher when you have one party controlling the governorship and the other party controlling the legislature. That makes sense. So in divided government, we see high gridlock during the Wilson-Duke-Majan years, and unsurprisingly, Gray Davis comes in and he gets along with the legislature a lot better. Schwarzenegger, actually, in 2004, accomplishes a lot, and we have very low gridlock. So it's not impossible for the legislature to solve issues. I mean, sure, they have issues that they haven't resolved this session. They haven't fixed California's 30-year-old water wars yet. So join the club. I mean, lots of legislatures haven't fixed that. So on this sense, and this evaluation, and I guess I should have a third point of data here, Senator Bagley, which is joint alcohol consumption. But on these two, we don't see that things are getting worse and worse and worse, and we don't see that the legislature is doing terribly. Here's the second thing where you're trying to look at, this is a measure that's trying to gauge the policy congruence. How much the legislature and the governor are agreeing on laws that get it right for the citizens of every state in the nation. So this is a couple researchers at Columbia who got polling data on 39 areas and checked the laws of each state in those 39 areas and ranked the states based on how many times they did what the majority voter wanted. And guess what? California was number one in the nation in the most congruent policy. Now, when we miss, we're off to the left, and that's something that bothers people. But we have sort of in this evaluation of the legislative system, we do the best. Now, our budget, the efficiency of our budget, what this graph prepared by Eric McGee tells you is we used to get budgets done early in the 50s and 60s, and now, as we all know, we have budget delays that are stretching further and further. And so clearly, you know, because agreement on the budget process requires the two parties to bridge that ideological gulf, right? They can't just force it through on 50 votes. We have late budgets, right? But efficiency is not the only thing we should worry about. We should also think about budget representation. How well do our budgets fit what the state wants? Well, in the past, we've done pretty well at this. with Ronald Reagan, with Pete Wilson, with the first sort of Schwarzenegger, the first budget Schwarzenegger legislature budget deal this year, we basically, when we had times of deficit, we split it down the middle with half tax cuts and half spending, half tax increases and half spending cuts. And as the Jack's data showed, that's what most voters want. In this last budget deal this summer, we didn't do that, right? We did this almost entirely through spending cuts. We had a red budget in a blue state. And so I think now we have to say that the two-thirds rule in this last budget deal has gotten us away from having a representative budget that looks like what Californians want, what California wants. So how do we talk about fixing this? I'm going to propose three things, and they're all going to be attempts to bundle things that my former comrades at Berkeley when I was a grad student here would like, and my current colleagues at the Hoover Institution would be interested. So where can we find common ground on solutions for California government that go after the biggest problems, which is a budget process that's constrained and late and not representing what Californians want? The first would be to end future ballot box budgeting by requiring that initiatives identify a funding source. So whether that initiative creates a new program, whether that initiative enhances penalties and will send more people to state prison, whether that initiative cuts taxes, whatever that initiative does, if it costs money, we need to know where that money will come from. 75% of voters, we put this on the field poll, 75% of voters back this. Now, that could erode, but in some ways, a part of the reason why they back this is this gives more power to the people. It allows the people to prescribe exactly what trade-offs they want when they're voting for something. It's truth in advertising in the initiative process. And it also stops the voters from writing checks that the legislature then has to cash, right? Where the legislature has to decide to make terrible, tough choices to fund what voters ask them to, and then voters don't like the legislature, and we have this spiral of mistrust. So that's the first idea I'd propose, and this is not something that's radical. The state of Arizona does this. The second thing would be to amend term limits, and I'm very happy to sound like a broken record on this. This conference has turned out to be the term limits reform launch party, so I hope we'll all sign the petition on our way out. I think we see bipartisan consensus, not only the people in this room. We saw this when the governor and the lieutenant governor were both recently gave speeches asking for their three things. They both included this measure. They would let legislators spend up to 12 years in whichever house voters would keep sending them back to, so they could get on that committee, develop expertise, and serve over a time period and really do what voters sent them to do. I think the important compromise pieces of this is it needs to decrease the total number of years from which people can serve from 14 to 12. That's something that makes voters much more comfortable with. And 65% of California residents supported this in a recent PPIC poll. You need to, as Senator Hancock wisely is doing with her version, you need to make this not apply to the legislators who are in power right now to make it clear that there's no conflict of interest. And finally, I think this will do best if it comes through citizen initiative, right? If it doesn't come out of the legislature, I appreciate the efforts, but I think it'll do better at the ballot box if it comes from a citizen initiative. And also in the campaign, never runs any ads with political scientists. That's a proven loser for term limits initiatives. And finally, the last thing is one that we've heard talked about a lot, shifting the budget vote from two-thirds to a simple majority or 55% to put us in line with other states. But I think this needs to be balanced with something for the minority, right? Because in some ways this would give the minority party in the legislature, who have voters who they're duly elected to represent, almost no legs to stand on. So what could compensate for that? Well, I think we can draw our lessons from the U.S. government. Right, because I don't think comparing California to other states is important, but we're not like Arkansas and Rhode Island. So while it's true that those are the only other places crazy enough to pass a budget by two-thirds vote, I think what we should do is look at Congress. And Congress has two different processes that they treat very differently, just like we do, the legislative and a budget process. Congress's legislative process gives the minority a big role. Through the filibuster in the Senate, it lets the minority have a voice in the legislative process. But Congress's budget process, the budget resolution and the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act that really puts that into practice, this is analogous to California's budget. There, Congress says, well, this is so important, we need to do it every year. Let's make this a simple majority. California does it exactly backwards, right? Which doesn't make sense. But if we're going to get rid of the two-thirds vote for the budget, I think we should take seriously Congress's model and give the minority party a bigger role in the legislative process. Right now, the reason 75% of the bills are authored by Democrats is because many, many Republican bills, including ones that would have majority support, get killed on the suspense file. Suspense file is what the California legislature uses to kill bills without votes, and the majority party uses it to stop bills on which majority moderates would ally with the minority party to pass things that are right in the middle of California politics. And by getting rid of the suspense file, it would guarantee those bills a vote. That would mean more moderate legislation would be passed in the California legislature, or if it dies, it has to die by a public vote which you could hold people accountable. It would also allow the moderate members who are in the legislature right now but don't have the ability to show that by sort of rebelling against their majority leaders by voting for any of these bills, by ever making common ground with the minority party, it would allow them to show their stripes. And in a recent research project, I worked with a couple colleagues to look at the bills that go through suspense and the bills that get exempted from the suspense file because of how they're written. And the California's partisan polarization looks a lot different. So the dotted line is bills that come through suspense. You see a lot of Democrats on the left, a lot of Republicans on the right, nobody in the middle. The bills that escape suspense are in a solid line. You see more moderate legislators showing their moderate stripes when they get to cast a vote on these bills. So those would be the three compromises that I would propose for California. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.